A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on June 9, 1996, in the series, I Do Believe, entitled, God Has a Grander Scheme. The scripture readings are Acts 10, verses 34 through 48, and Luke 4, verses 16 through 30. The texts for the sermon are Acts 10, verses 34 to 35, and Luke 4, verse 27. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I Do Believe, a series for Eastertide that spilled over into Pentecost, but a time to share some of the great affirmations of faith, the things that we really do believe. And this morning I bring the service, the series, to a conclusion with the claim that God has a grander scheme, that God is about something far grander than we have yet dreamed of. And you may say to me, on what basis do you make such a claim? And I would say to you, on the basis of the biblical story, the tradition of which we're a part, and concrete human experience. Simply the experience of being alive, being human in the world today. I do believe that God has a grander scheme than we have yet dreamed of, because I believe that we are part of a process, a cosmic process that has been emerging now for 10, 20 billion years. We, humankind, are that part of that process that has come to awareness and to self-consciousness. And I do believe on the edge of the third millennium that we have entered into a new period, a new circumstance. Something new has happened in our world. We're in an era. We've moved into it. We're moving into it. No sharp edges. But this is a time in the history of the cosmos, in which there is tremendous revolutionary transformation going on. So I base my claim that God has a grander scheme, first of all, on just the experience of being human today. For example, global consciousness. That's something new. We are the first people that have ever lived that are able to experience the totality of history at one time. We have a global consciousness. The image of global consciousness is suggested by a Catholic theologian, Ewart Cousins, who uses the image of planet Earth suspended out in space. You've seen it on our stamps, you see it on the TV, you've seen pictures, posters. Planet Earth, beautiful and blue against that black universe, the background. And there it is, in its orbit, hanging, as it were, suspended, a thing of beauty, small, fragile. And yet, from the astronaut's point of view, from outer space, we can see planet Earth, and we can see its wholeness. And we can understand visually, as never before, as no generation before, that it is interconnected, that it is indivisible. The astronaut Russell Swigert on Apollo 7 writes about the experience of being out there and looking back on planet Earth. And he says it's so small, and it's so beautiful, and you go around it again and again and again. And you cross over borders and boundaries over which people fight and kill each other. And from outer space, as you see the whole organic interconnectedness, you know that those lines don't exist. In our day, we have entered into an era of global consciousness, where we begin to think of the whole and to understand as never before that we are part of the whole, and that nothing in this whole earthly globe is foreign to us. There is a convergence of cultures, a convergence of peoples, a convergence of communication that is making us one. Global consciousness marks this age. On the frontiers of biology and physics, amazing breakthroughs are taking place. And we begin to understand that no matter how far out one goes, or how minutely one examines inside the cell of the human body, there is a unitary structure to reality. We are a part of an evolutionary process with a unity of structure, which is amazing, coming more and more to light in our day. And because of this global consciousness, because of this convergence of peoples and cultures, there is a dialogue between the religions today. It's actually going on, and it is imperative that it continue to go on and deepen. A German philosopher in the mid-century wrote a book about the first axial period. Axial coming from axis. And his point was that there have been moments in which human consciousness has been flipped over, radically changed. He speaks about the period 800 to 200 before the Common Era. During that 600 years, peaking about the year 500 before the Common Era, there arose in three separate places around the globe a change, a transformation in human consciousness. In China, in India, in the Eastern Mediterranean. Out of that transformation, which happened separately yet simultaneously, everything that we are as human beings, has arisen from that transformation of consciousness. Now, this is the kind of data that you can study and you can verify. And so Carl Jaspers says that was the first axial period. Human consciousness moved from a kind of tribal consciousness and a connectedness with the earth to an individuality, a self-consciousness, an over-againstness. In this first axial period, which has been going on now for over 2,000 years, everything that has developed from the human story is the consequence of that transformation of consciousness. But according to Cousins that I quoted a moment ago, we've moved into the second axial period. Now that's quite a claim. The claim is that the life we're living in the era of which we're a part, there's another axial transformation of human consciousness. It is a transformation which is marked by that global consciousness that begins to see things as interconnected and as a whole. And it is in this second axial period that we are beginning to rub up against other cultures and other faiths, other spiritualities, and find it imperative that we dialogue and that we come to new understandings. We, in our concrete human experience, are living in a dynamic era in which human consciousness is being transformed. And if that is the case, then it is imperative that we understand our faith, that we understand our lives, that we understand God in the light of this transformation of human consciousness. Well, how are we going to do that? Well, we go back to our founding story. We'll go back to our founding story and the tradition of which we're a part. That's why I read the 10th chapter of Acts this morning, the story of Peter and Cornelius. In the book of Acts, Luke, who wrote the gospel, tells us some more about Christian origins. And one of the things that we've noted in these last weeks is that a critical insight in those Christian origins, those early days, was that Jesus was a Jew. Well, we've always known that. The disciples were Jews. The early Christian movement, as we call it a Christian movement, was a Jewish movement. And the conflict within the New Testament was an intra-Jewish conflict. It wasn't like there were Jews and Gentile Christians. It was an intra-Jewish conflict. In 70 AD, when Rome destroyed Jerusalem and the temple, the identity of the future of Judaism was at stake. And there was a strong Jesus movement. There was a stronger rabbinic Pharisaic movement. And the future was really in contention between those two movements. The Jesus Jewish people were trying to convince other Jewish people that Jesus really was God's anointed. They were trying to convince other Jewish brothers and sisters that Jesus was the Messiah, that he was crucified, risen, ascended, and that he would soon return. The rabbinic Jewish movement had its roots in Moses, in the Torah. It had continuity, deep roots in the past. And these two movements were in conflict. The Jesus Jewish movement was trying to convince other Jews to follow Jesus. Probably one of the reasons that it was so unsuccessful was the fact that this soon return of Jesus simply didn't happen. And consequently, eventually, there was a Jesus Jewish movement that was supplemented by a Gentile mission, and eventually we have the Christian movement, and there was the ongoing continuity of Judaism in the rabbinic tradition. Now, when Luke is trying to explain some of that, the origin, the originating story, the story of Peter and Cornelius is critical. It's a paradigm. It's a model. You know the story. Peter has a vision, a knock at the door. They say, come to Cornelius' house. Peter says, Cornelius' house? He's a Gentile. They say, yes, God calls you. Peter goes with some fear and trembling. And Cornelius tells him his story. Peter tells about Jesus. Boom. The Spirit of God falls on that group, and there's another Pentecost. They're speaking in tongues, they're praising God, and Peter said, my goodness, who would have thunk it? Same thing that happened with us. And these people aren't circumcised, and they eat pork chops. So, now, Peter had to scratch his head. Luke tells us what happened. You go to the next chapter, Peter tells what happened to those back in Jerusalem who disagreed with his going into the house of a Gentile. Luke saw this moment as a model, as a window through which to say God was doing a new thing now. This was the discovery of Paul, who was the missionary to the Gentiles, to the nations. And this was the experience of Peter. There were those who didn't agree. And if you would read the 15th chapter of Acts, you would find the Jerusalem Council where they came together to discuss this thing. Peter came and told his story about Cornelius. Paul and Kate came and told his story about his mission activity out in the Roman Empire. Barnabas told his story. And old James, Jesus' brother, sort of stroked his beard, took it all in, and he said, well, let me see. Oh, yes, there's a prophet who says thus and so. This must be that. I conclude. Now, this was the breakthrough, folks. James said, James is an observant Jew. He believes that Jesus was the Messiah, but he's an observant Jew. He didn't give up his Judaism. But now he hears all of this. And he says, I agree with you, Paul. I agree with you, Peter. What must be happening is that God is now embracing by grace the Gentiles, the nations, without having them first become observant Jews. Something new is happening in the world. In other words, our Jewish faith, our Jewish understanding, our Jewish revelation of God, our Jewish worship, all of that is true, all of that is authentic, all of that is adequate, but none of that is absolute. Now something new is happening. Something new has emerged on the scene. Now Gentiles, without submitting to the rite of circumcision, without following the dietary laws, without all of the social separation and associations and so forth, without all of that which is part of the Mosaic tradition, Gentiles seem to be in touch with God, the God of Israel. That was the insight that Luke is setting forth in the story of Peter and Cornelius. Here, the story of Jesus is told, the Spirit falls, and these people, uncircumcised, not keeping any of the observance rituals of Judaism, have obviously an experience of the living God. So now we have a paradigm or a model. When there is a shift, when there is a transformation in human consciousness or understanding, we can see from our own story that sometimes God does a new thing. If Peter had reasoned deductively, he would have said, I have this word of the Lord. I have this tradition of my forebears. I will no way go into Cornelius' house. I have been taught all my life how not to relate to Gentiles. And therefore, don't bother me with a vision. Don't bother me with Cornelius' story. Because I know by a given truth before I experience anything what my answer is going to be. But there is another way in philosophical reasoning. Not deductive reasoning, but inductive reasoning. And inductive reasoning is what has transformed the whole modern period. Inductive reasoning is the scientific method. Inductive reasoning says, well, let me see. There's this, and this, and this, and this. And when I put them all together, it seems to me that this is the case. Now, do you see the difference? Most of the church, and most of its experience and tradition, reasons deductively. It knows the major premise before it encounters concrete experience. But at those points of breakthrough in the history of the church, concrete experience has shattered the forms. And the thing that we are beginning to learn, if we will only open our eyes, if we will only open our minds to it, is that religious forms and structures are human containers. And those human containers are adequate. The Jew had a true revelation of the true God. The Jew had a true worship of the true God. And the whole structure was adequate. And it still is. But what those Jesus Jews determined 2,000 years ago was that what was adequate was not necessarily absolute. And that it was possible for the eternal God to mediate grace, to unveil glory, using other containers. So now, 2,000 years ago, we've got the grand tradition of Israel's faith, and we've got a fledgling Christian movement whose total beginning was Jewish, but moved out into the Gentile world. So, I would suggest to you this morning that what we have in Luke's telling of this Peter Cornelius story is a model, an example, a paradigm of the way in which we have to do our theology in every age. What we see there is how newness emerges. Concrete experience shows the inadequacy of the current form, shatters the form, and finds a new expression. Now, I want to say to you that that was 2,000 years ago. But if those who are insightful into what's happening in our world are correct, and I don't know how we can deny it, frankly, then we are at another hinge point in history. Then we are at another axial period. And if we are in another axial period with a revolutionary transformation of human consciousness through globalization, through the close encounter with other cultures, through technology, communication, and all of that that's a part of our daily life now, if that's the case, then how will we understand the gospel in our day, and how will we communicate the gospel in our day, and how will we relate in this global community? I want to suggest to you something that I believe passionately with all my heart: Christian exclusivism is over. It will not prevail. It cannot prevail. And I believe that if we would open our eyes and simply experience the world of which we're a part, we would know that it cannot be the will of God that we should live in that kind of isolation and that blindness that refuses to see the possibility of God doing some new thing in our day. Why in the world do I have to deny your truth in order to have my own? Why do I have to deny your joy in order to rejoice in my own? Why do I have to deny the fruitfulness and the giftedness and the devotion of another in order to celebrate before my own God? This is not a call to some kind of world religion in which we take a dash of Hinduism, a shot of Buddhism, a little Judaism, some Islam for good measure, and put it into a blender and come out with some kind of new bland faith that has no particularity, that has no history, that has no family. Absolutely not. This is a time for me as a Christian to dig deeper, to do what they did 2,000 years ago, to go back to the book, to look at it again, to say, oh my goodness, I never saw it that way before, and now it hits me from every angle. This is not a time for me to become less Christian. It is for me to become a deeper Christian in order that I may come to the table, that I may share those treasures, and that I may receive from others their treasures in order that in our respective families we may be mutually and reciprocally enriched. That, it seems to me, is so reasonable. It is so simple. It is so right. Exclusivism is dead. Don't you see it? Exclusivism cannot live in a world of global consciousness. And what we are seeing in all of the resistance is the lash, thrashing and flailing of the tail that is fearful and afraid to move into the future, confident in the God who calls us from the future. Why? Why do we demand to have a corner on the truth? Why do we demand that that way of salvation which is ours is the only way of salvation? Why? What is there about it? I read the fourth chapter of, I'm going to quit in a minute here. I read the fourth chapter of Luke, not because it's Jesus' inaugural sermon, but in order that you might see his response, the response of the crowd to his inaugural sermon. Something happened in that passage if you read it again. First they said, my goodness, he's speaking graciously. Isn't this Joseph's boy? And all at once they turned around because apparently he had been too inclusive. He had done some things in the outskirts, and they wanted him to do it here. They wanted to claim him. Maybe he would have been good for the local economy. I don't know if he'd set up shop, the charismatic holy man. And then they said, you know, who is this guy after? Who does he think he is? Because his reach was too broad. His hometown folk were going to put him over the cliff. And of course, he wasn't very smart. Instead of trying to calm their fears, he said to them, let me tell you out of your own tradition, out of your own book about Elijah. When Elijah was around, there were a lot of people suffering from the famine, but he went to a widow way over there on the other side of the world. And when Elisha was around, there were lepers all over Israel, and he went over to Syria and he healed Naaman. In other words, what Jesus was saying to him is, look, my hometown folks, it's in your own book. God has always had a reach that is broader than we can conceive of. Now, I ask you this. What is there about us? What is there about us human beings that needs to have a corner on it all? What is there about us that wants to have the biggest and the best? What is it about nationalism, my nation, right or wrong? What is it about racism, my race and the rest are oppressed and discriminated against? What is it about religious exclusivism that says my way, my truth, my salvation is all there is? What is there about us? It is not the nice part of us, folks. It is something that is, well, it's the seedbed of violence and of hatred and of war. It has caused more disharmony and more disturbance and more tragedy in the world than anything else. This need to have it all right here, my little thing. Good God, it's over. It is over. It'll never be able to prevail before the light of day in the world that's unfolding. So I say to you, God has a grander scheme than anything we've yet dreamed of. 2,000 years ago, the apostles thought they were bringing this message to all of the nations, and soon Jesus would come and the end wouldn't come. The end didn't come, folks. It's 2,000 years later, with all we know from science, all we know from biology, psychology, the behavioral sciences, all we know about the close encounter of cultures and religions and languages, one would think that an enlightened person would be unable to stick with something 2,000 years ago as though that was the end. When all of this has happened, you can't just write off 2,000 years of experience. Here we are. We live in this world. We live in this world to worship God. We live in this world to follow Jesus. We live in this world. And we realize that we've only had a glimpse of God's glory. And it seems to me that to give up exclusivism is to give up the main element of human meanness to enable us to relax, to worship God, to understand our neighbor, to embrace one another, and to dance with God into a future that is grander than we've ever dreamed. That's all I got to say.